I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Well, the two presidential candidates debated each other last night for the last time, marking the beginning of the end of this presidential campaign. From now on, it's the race to the finish line. But first, a fact check. For that, we turn to Janet Hook, of the Los Angeles Times. She joins us from Washington, D.C. Janet, give us an overall sense. How did the candidates fare on fact versus fiction?
There weren't any big whoppers, I would say, of misleading facts, of facts being distorted, though there sure was a lot of statistics thrown around in a way that was either out of context or misleading.
Well, in fact, Mark Zandi, who's a chief economist at economy.com and appears on our program, told your paper it's not a question of misstating numbers, it's just a question of which numbers you state. So let's listen to some of them. Let's start with health care. Here's Senator Kerry talking about his plan for the uninsured.
I have a plan to cover all Americans. We're going to make it affordable and accessible. We're going to let everybody buy into the same health care plan senators and congressmen give themselves.
Janet Hook, LA Times, what's the record?
Well, actually, this isn't just misstating numbers. There's no number in there, and it's really quite an exaggeration of what Kerry's trying to do. It's kind of an unnecessary exaggeration because his plan is quite ambitious enough to sell itself. He would extend health insurance coverage quite far. It would reduce the number of uninsured people by tens of millions of people. Yeah. But it doesn't cover everyone. It doesn't guarantee coverage for anyone.
Right. We understand he would reduce the 45 million uninsured by half. Well, let's take a look next at the Kerry record in the Senate as presented by President Bush.
He voted to increase taxes 98 times. When they tried to reduce taxes, he voted against that 127 times.
So did Senator Kerry really vote 98 times to increase taxes?
Now, this is one of the favorite gimmicks of the Bush campaign ads, to say that Kerry voted X times for something that they oppose. But it's kind of misleading. It kind of pads the number in that they take, you know, there's one tax bill on the floor and say there are 10 votes on 10 different amendments. And if you count those as 10 different votes, it's not voting to raise taxes 10 times, and that's how they get such a run-up total.
Right. In fact, John Kerry responded that he supported or voted for tax cuts over 600 times, which who knows if that number is inflated
as well.
Right, it
probably has the same overall effect. I mean, the thing is that they're trying to quantify something that is clear. Bush is more inclined to cut taxes than Kerry is.
Okay, let's check off some of the other accusations. John Kerry says that President Bush never met with the Black Congressional Caucus. Bush said he did. What's true?
Well, this is an interesting one because Bush is technically true in that he did meet with the Congressional Black Caucus once right after he was inaugurated. But then what happened, it's sort of interesting, the Black Caucus repeatedly asked to meet with President Bush, and he refused. So that's the reality that Kerry's getting at. And so that the second time that he met with the Black Caucus, it was forced upon them because the Black Caucus went down to the White House and demanded to meet with Bush.
They were standing at the White House gates, we understand.
Right, right. So, you know, he literally speaking, he met with them.
Yeah, he did finally come out and meet with them. Well, John Kerry also said that President Bush said he wasn't concerned about Osama bin Laden. Let's listen to that.
6 months after he said Osama bin Laden must be caught dead or alive, this president was asked, where's Osama bin Laden? He said, I don't know. I don't really think about him very much. I'm not that concerned. We need a president who stays deadly focused on the real war on terror.
Mr. President.
I don't think I ever said I'm not worried about Osama bin Laden. It's kind of one of those exaggerations.
Exaggerations, was it?
No, it was not an exaggeration. It was, you know, lifted from, you know, words that actually came out of his mouth. He may not remember saying it. He may be sorry he said it. He may not have meant it at the time when he said it. I think his point at the time was sort of the war on terrorism is bigger than Osama bin Laden.
Right.
But he said those words.
Let's go to Pell Grants. This is the money given to low and middle income young people so that they can go to college. Kerry says that President Bush cut them. Here's the exchange.
Whew. Let me start with the Pell Grants. In his last litany of misstatements, he said, we cut Pell Grants. We've increased Pell Grants by 1 million students.
And here's John Kerry's response to that.
But you know why the Pell Grants have gone up in their numbers? Because more people qualify for them because they don't have money. But they're not getting the $5,100 the president promised them. They're getting less money.
So, Janet Hook, LA Times, what's true?
Well, what Kerry's referring to is during the campaign, Bush promised to increase the maximum Pell Grant to $5,100. That has not happened. On another level, though, I think because more people qualify for the money, the average size of the grant has gone down. So in that sense, you could say it's been cut. And what Bush refers to is, yes, more students are getting Pell Grants, but he kind of sort of can't take credit for it because it's not because of his policies that more students are getting grants. It's because more people are poor enough to qualify.
Hmm. Janet, thank you.
You're welcome.
Janet Hook, a reporter for the Los Angeles Times. So the two candidates did fling facts and figures at each other last night and had starkly different views on jobs, taxes, health care. Both candidates ducked questions on how to stop the Social Security system from going bankrupt. And unusually, John Kerry was the first to bring up faith.
And I think that everything you do in public life has to be guided by your faith, affected by your faith, but without transferring it in any official way to other people.
In another moment, a hush seemed to fall over the arena when the president spoke of how faith guides him.
Prayer and religion sustain me. I receive calmness in the storms of the presidency.
But which man won over the most undecided voters? Who won on style? Polls today are showing that the American public thinks John Kerry won, 39% to 25% in a CBS poll. A Gallup poll conducted for CNN and USA Today put Kerry the victor, 52 to 39%. Joining us on the line, two newspaper editors who've been watching very closely, Dennis Joyce, editorial page editor of the Arizona Daily Star in Tucson. That paper endorsed John Kerry earlier this month. Hi, Dennis.
Good afternoon to you.
And we have Gary Gilbert, executive editor of the Daily Oakland Press in Pontiac, Michigan. They endorsed George Bush this past Sunday. Welcome, Gary.
Hello.
So your editorials both say that the candidate you've endorsed is not perfect. Did anything that happened in the debate last night change your mind? Do you think it might have changed your readers' minds?
Well, it seems to me that as each debate moves along, people get to know Kerry better, and he's gaining from the exposure. And that's proving to be true in the poll results here in Arizona as well as nationwide.
Right. Well, Tom Shales of the Washington Post writes that nobody won big last night, including the American people. Both candidates seem to spin their wheels on a few domestic policy issues. Your thoughts, Gary?
I thought I doubt that anybody's mind was changed by last night's debate. I thought the president did a good job of appealing to his base. I thought President Bush did a good job in the opening. And it's important to score points early in the first 20 minutes. I thought as the debate went on that Senator Kerry did a much better job, seemed to be more focused as the debate continued. Senator Kerry needs to appear to be presidential, and I thought he did a good job of that last night for those people who stayed to the end of the debate.
And again, your paper endorsed George Bush.
Yes.
We'll make clear. Well, let's go back to a little bit more about what each of the candidates said about faith, because that was a compelling moment for both. Here's what the president had to say.
We ought to love our neighbor like we love ourselves. That's manifested in public policy through the faith-based initiative where we've unleashed the armies of compassion to help heal people who heard. I believe that God wants everybody to be free. That's what I believe. And that's one part of my foreign policy.
And here's what John Kerry said in response.
Well, I respect everything that the president has said and certainly respect his faith. I think it's important and I share it. I think that he just said that freedom is a gift from the Almighty. Everything is a gift from the Almighty.
Dennis Joyce in Tucson. A lot of people feel that John Kerry was the one who really had to let people know who he was when it came to issues like faith.
That's correct, and I think he further elaborated on his previous efforts to do that. Last night was his strongest statement yet. I think he, like Bush, both sounded very sincere in how faith guides their decisions. And in Kerry's case, I think he did a good job of distinguishing between his own personal faith and his duty as a public servant. Up till now, that has helped Bush more than Kerry.
I thought Senator Kerry did a good job in explaining his views last night on that. I'd also like to point out that in our editorial that endorsed George W. Bush for 4 more years, that we noted that he's imposed his personal religious views on public health and scientific research policies, and we think that's been to the country's detriment.
Well, speaking of policy, let's go to the issue of abortion. It didn't seem to be something the president wanted to talk about. Now, let's listen as moderator Bob Schieffer asks a question to President Bush about something John Kerry said about Roe versus Wade, which, as we know, legalized abortion.
He said that you had never said whether you would like to overturn Roe v. Wade. So I'd ask you directly.
What he's asking me is, will I have a litmus test for my judges? And the answer is, no, I will not have a litmus test. I will pick judges who will interpret the Constitution, but I'll have no litmus test.
Senator Kerry?
Well, again, the president didn't answer the question. I'll answer it straight to America. I'm not going to appoint a judge to the court who's going to undo a constitutional right, whether it's the First Amendment or the Fifth Amendment or some other right that's given under our courts.
Gary Gilbert, I want to go to you in Pontiac, Michigan. Again, a paper that endorsed George Bush. Your thoughts on that exchange?
I thought President Bush did a good job of appealing to his base. The people who support George Bush, I think, liked his answer.
Well, we also spoke to some people at Stan's Restaurant in Columbus, Ohio. This is a real battleground state, and Columbus and Stan's is the heart of the state. Mary Colts is a co-owner, and there was another worker we spoke to. Now, the candidates were each asked last night if they thought that homosexuality was a choice. President Bush said he didn't know. John Kerry referenced Dick Cheney's daughter, saying she didn't make a choice to be a lesbian. Here's what Mary Colts in Columbus thought of that.
When he outed Dick Cheney's daughter, I thought that was very tacky.
Others have said that, but when you say outed, that usually means reveals for the first
time.
Well,
you know, I didn't know, and I don't care to know.
Dennis Joyce in Tucson, Arizona, I want to go to you first because I know you have to go, but also, interesting response to John Kerry's remarks about Dick Cheney's daughter. There's a perception that he outed Cheney's daughter.
Yeah, I think that's just, that's coming from a lack of knowledge by the particular respondents.
But if there are many people who feel that way.
I'm not sure if there are.
Yeah. Dennis, thanks so much.
It's my pleasure.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Gary Gilbert in Pontiac, Michigan, what do you think your readers will think about John Kerry's referencing Dick Cheney's daughter?
I think the conservative readers will find that to be a bit insensitive. They're looking for reasons to dislike John Kerry. I would think that would be a moment that they didn't like him.
That's Gary Gilbert, executive editor of the Daily Oakland Press in Pontiac, Michigan. We also spoke with Dennis Joyce, editorial page editor of the Arizona Daily Star. He had to go. Gary's going to stay with us. And when we come back, what did the candidates say about the women in their lives and how one undecided voter made up her mind? That and more when we return. You're listening to Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We're talking about last night's third and final presidential debate with Gary Gilbert, executive editor of the Daily Oakland Press in Pontiac, Michigan, a paper that endorsed George Bush last Sunday. And Gary, we're going to be speaking with an undecided voter in just a moment. But what for you was the most standout moment of the debate?
I thought for those people who made it to the end of the debate, if they stuck in there for 90 minutes, perhaps the most interesting moment of the debate was when Bob Schieffer asked the candidates about the influence of strong women in their lives. I thought President Bush did a very good job of answering that question, talking about the influence that Laura Bush has on him. He made a little joke about how she tells him to stand up straight and not scowl. I thought that was a good moment for the president.
Well, in fact, we have that moment. He was asked what was the most important thing that he learned. Here was his response.
To listen to him. To stand up straight and not scowl.
The president went on to praise Laura Bush's compassion and joke that she speaks English better than he does. He said he fell in love with her at first sight. John Kerry began by speaking about his mother.
My mom passed away a couple of years ago, and just before I was deciding to run, and she was in the hospital, and I I went in to talk to her and tell her what I was thinking of doing. And she looked at me from her hospital bed, and she just looked at me and she said, remember, integrity, integrity, integrity. Those are the three words that she left me with.
And John Kerry, in addition to that moment, was also very self-deprecating.
Absolutely. I thought he did a good job there. He's known his wife, Teresa, is probably known primarily for her vast fortune. He talked about how all three men, meaning President Bush, Bob Schieffer, and Senator Kerry, had married up in the world, and that some would say Senator Kerry more than others.
Yes, he said that of himself, and then he wanted to say, I can take it. And he also spoke about his daughters. It was a humanizing moment. Do you think it felt real to people?
I thought it was one of the best moments of the three debates, because they finally seemed to let their guard down a little bit, and instead of trying to be belligerent or confrontational.
Yeah. 39-year-old Amy Losi of Akron, Ohio, was actually part of a focus group of undecided voters. She said going into the debate, she was very angry at George Bush, didn't like him, thought he had used his own agenda about Saddam Hussein to go to war. But she also didn't like John Kerry, although she was leaning towards him for domestic issue reasons. She took very careful notes during the debate. She came up with this scorecard. Let's listen.
I came out with one hit for Bush, 6 for Kerry, and 5 that were either a tie or a no win. They were a wash.
Oh, interesting. So can you tell them?
So I gave Kerry education. I gave him the minimum wage. I gave him the homosexuality issue, although I don't approve of him bringing up Dick Cheney's daughter. Mm. I think that's very tacky. I gave him Social Security. I definitely gave him Roe versus Wade. And I gave him the senior medical care.
So you're pro-choice. To Mr. Bush?
To Mr. Bush, I gave him immigration. Mm-hmm. I think that his plan for immigration is much more controlled than John Kerry's.
Okay, keep going with the Bush list.
That's it. He only got one.
Oh.
And that was it, immigration.
Huh. Well, then some would say, Amy,
I know, but when I look down at my list of tacky or stupid, inappropriate things, I've got Kerry for 4 or 5 and Bush only for 1.
So overall, Amy, you are you still undecided a couple weeks before the election?
What I feel like I have to do is vote for John Kerry on the Democratic issues.
Oh.
Even though I have to vote for him, I don't feel that he's the man to be president.
Gary Gilbert in Pontiac, Michigan. Your thoughts?
Isn't that wonderful? Wouldn't you like to think that all voters are so prepared that they paid such close attention?
But she's going to go into the voting booth kind of holding her nose.
Exactly. And I think it's really interesting. She does reflect some national polling that shows that on policies, people prefer John Kerry. But for personal characteristics, people prefer President Bush.
And that's something. Well, we want to touch on one subject that Amy mentioned that moderator Bob Schieffer said was the one he got the most email about, and that's immigration. That's where she liked President Bush's comments, so let's hear them. President Bush said he saw immigration as a serious problem, a security issue, an economic issue, and a human rights issue.
I believe there ought to be a temporary worker card that allows a willing worker and a willing employer to mate up, so long as there's not an American willing to do the job, to join up in order to be able to fulfill the employer's needs. That has the benefit of making sure our employers aren't breaking the law as they try to fill their workforce needs. It makes sure that the people coming across the border are humanely treated, that they're not kept in the shadows of our society, that they're able to go back and forth to see their families.
President Bush went on to say that I don't believe we ought to have amnesty. John Kerry's plan didn't sound that different from the president's. He said toughen the border, a guest worker program, target businesses that employ aliens, have an earned legalization program. But a hot-button issue. Gary Gilbert, your thoughts on how they sounded?
I did not think that either candidate did a particularly good job of distinguishing himself from the other on the immigration topic. Kerry did say that he would crack down on employers who hire undocumented workers. I think that was a position that has not been voiced by President Bush.
Mm-hmm. Gary Gilbert, one last question to you again. Pontiac, Michigan, a paper that endorsed George Bush. We heard from Amy Losi, an undecided voter who made up her mind after last night. What do you think an undecided voter might have to hear at this point to make up theirs?
I would be stunned to find out that there were any undecided voters left at this point. I realize that we have almost 3 weeks to go, but the candidates have done, a good job drawing distinctions between themselves, between their parties, between their platforms at this point.
Gary Gilbert, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Gary is executive editor of the Daily Oakland Press in Pontiac, Michigan. And tomorrow on Here and Now, the campaign through the media prism. One broadcast conglomerate will air an anti-Kerry film. Is that fair? And was an ABC News internal memo anti-Bush? That's tomorrow. Stay with us. More ahead Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In Iraq today, bombs went off in a market and popular cafe inside the heavily guarded Green Zone, where most of the Iraqi U.S. coalition is housed. At least five Americans who worked for the private U.S. security firm DynCorp were killed. Iraqi officials say the attacks may have been by suicide bombers. If so, this would be the first time insurgents have managed to get inside the Green Zone and successfully detonate bombs in the heart of the government. As the war in Iraq goes on, some American soldiers have followed in the footsteps of thousands of soldiers who fled to Canada during the Vietnam War. And Canada is considering granting refugee status to American service personnel who have gone there to avoid combat. Peace groups, which have been supporting the deserters, claim that significant numbers of disillusioned American troops may flee to Canada if the refugee board agrees they should be treated as political fugitives. From the Canadian side of Niagara Falls, Malcolm Brabant reports.
Amid the honeymooners and tourists feeling the thunder of the Niagara Falls and getting drenched by the spray is a slim, tall young man with short, neat red hair. 19-year-old Brandon Huey has a determined look as he gazes across the raging Niagara River towards the United States less than a mile away. If there's any regret, his eyes don't betray it. This is the first time that Huey has ever been abroad. His stay in Canada could be a long one, because if he returns to America, he could be clapped in jail for deserting the U.S. Army before he could be sent to Iraq.
For me, what triggered it was George Bush said that Iraq had this massive arsenal of weapons of mass destruction and ties to al-Qaeda. And by the time I graduated basic training in November of last year, the U.S. had been in Iraq for many months, and none of those things had been found. So I basically felt that I was going to be sent overseas to fight for lies and to shoot at someone else or risk losing my own life for causes that my government couldn't even justify.
In leafy, peaceful western Toronto, former paratrooper Jeremy Hinsman and his Vietnamese wife Na take their 2-year-old son Liam to the park in his toy trailer. After serving in Afghanistan, Hinsman asked the U.S. Army to accept him as a conscientious objector, which would have allowed him to remain in the military in a role where he wouldn't be required to kill. There was no response, so he went AWOL.
It's an illegal war, it's criminal, and had I taken part, I'd be complicit in a criminal enterprise. And one may say that the Nuremberg principle only would apply to officers or policymakers, but I think that it's evident, especially in light of the Abu Ghraib scandal, that our administration is perfectly willing to scapegoat lower enlisted soldiers for their policy decisions.
The deserters claim they're entitled to refugee status because if deported to the U.S., they would be jailed for their political beliefs. Their legal team believes their case has been helped by Kofi Annan's assertion that the war in Iraq was illegal. The Canadian government, which opposes the refugee application, disagrees.
Kofi Annan made that comment. He probably regrets it. The fact is that we don't need the Security Council's approval, thank God, to intervene anywhere, because otherwise we wouldn't have intervened in a number of places since 1945, which the UN didn't authorize.
Major General Lewis Mackenzie, the former United Nations commander in Bosnia, is one of Canada's most prominent soldiers.
I don't think it's the soldiers' right. It's not my right as a general to determine whether it's an illegal war or not. So the leadership of the country, the commander-in-chief, determined that this was a legal intervention by the United States. They join that military, and they take what goes with the contract.
That's an argument that doesn't wash with Charlie Diamond, who's riding the streetcar in Toronto, where he's lived since 1968, after fleeing across the 49th parallel to avoid being sent to Vietnam. He's part of an anti-war group that's setting up an escape network to help other Americans waiting for the refugee board's decision.
The personal consequences for the people who are doing it are just so overwhelming, and they're so draconian, and they're so cross the Rubiconish. I mean, like, once you've done it, you've done it. I'm not going to tell somebody to go into exile and give up never seeing their family again, or to never be able to go home for a funeral, to visit a sick family, to take care of them, or to go home for births or deaths. What right do I have to tell other people to make that kind of decision? I mean, if they've made that decision and they're here in Canada, and I'll do what I can to help them while they're here.
And people wanted to have little posters that say, war resistors welcome here.
The deserters support group meeting here in Toronto expects to be very busy soon, because it believes speculation that after the election, the United States may introduce some form of conscription to provide the troops it needs to fulfill the Iraq mission.
I believe that if there is a draft, if the war goes on, that we may be looking at numbers similar to the number who came when the Vietnam War was on, and that was something in the range of 50,000.
Jeffrey Howes is another Vietnam draft dodger who settled in Canada. And as attorney for the deserters, he's become a contact point for American soldiers wavering over Iraq.
Now, as it stands right now, there's only a trickle of people who've actually come across. I'm aware of six at this point, but I'm also aware of many people who talk to me from all over the world who are saying, I'm coming, or if I have to go back to Iraq, I'm coming, and so on. So I think the potential there is there for quite a substantial number of people.
The vast majority of Canadians opposed the invasion of Iraq, and so the deserters are getting a warm welcome here, although not by everyone. Fred Klein is a colleague of draft dodger Charlie Diamond, but doesn't share his views.
I'm opposed to granting political asylum to American deserters, because that undermines the American war effort, which I favor.
Those sentiments are positively restrained in comparison to the flood of hate mail and death threats that have been directed from the United States towards Jeremy Hinzman.
Are you a coward?
I don't think I'm a coward. Not that it's a big deal. I've jumped out of airplanes. I've said over and over again, I'd take bullets for anybody. I just don't want to shoot anybody. And if that's cowardly, well, then I'll stand on a tower and say I'm a coward. Call me a coward for not wanting to kill people. Is that bad? So be it. then I'm a bad person because I don't want to kill anybody.
The people that call me a traitor now are and obviously the same people that support George Bush. And George Bush, in the Vietnam era, he enlisted in the National Guard specifically to avoid service in Vietnam. And there's actually controversy now that he didn't even do his service then. So I guess the major difference is that, you know, I'm admitting that I've deserted the U.S. military.
Not many people on this side of the Niagara Falls would disagree with Brandon Huey's remark. Polls show that 4 out of 5 Canadians hope George Bush loses the presidential election. So it would be politically unpopular for the Canadian authorities to return the deserters to the United States, even if they lose the case.
That's Malcolm Brabant reporting from Canada. Still to come, the real-life story of a British prince hidden away from the rest of the royal family because of what would now be called autism. You're listening to Here and Now. The Charles River runs between Boston and neighboring Cambridge here in Massachusetts. The banks are dotted with boathouses and rowers who set out in their thin rowing sculls like eager water bugs every day, rain, shine, or squirrels.
There's something going on with the squirrels. They're swimming. We've never seen that. If it were 300 years ago, this might augur the end of time.
Have you come across squirrels while you're rowing?
We've seen a couple, yeah.
Yeah, we did. Yeah, today.
Tell me.
Well, the squirrels, they get all bunched up, and they got these little tiny little arms, and they'll start just squirreling their way across the river. It just looks like they're running away from something.
It's the first time I've ever seen one in 8 years of rowing.
I've seen two of them. I couldn't believe it. I thought they were marmots or perhaps rats. They're squirrels, perfect little squirrel faces, and you'd think they'd get soaked with water and sort of sink, but nope, right up there. Just perfect in their squirrelness.
If you talk to the woman over there in the blue jacket, she'll give you a squirrel confrontation story.
All right. I have a lot of squirrel confrontation stories, but on Sunday last weekend, I had one go up onto my boat. It was swimming up onto my boat and right across. There's little scratch marks in the deck.
Just like, excuse me, just passing through?
There were three of us out in singles, and we just stopped. And all of a sudden, I hear this and feel it, and there it is on my boat. Fortunately, it kept going because I was ready to jump out. There's no way I'm going to have a squirrel in my lap.
Has this ever happened before?
No, this is the first year ever that we've seen squirrels swimming, and I know that I'm not the first person to have a squirrel on my boat this year either, but it's insane.
A listener named Catherine alerted us to the squirrel problem on the river, and then there were other anecdotes. A squirrel toppling from the ceiling onto a performer during an outdoor production of Shakespeare's Much Ado About Nothing. Reports of squirrels literally tearing up the scenery and the lighting, and tearing up everyone's gardens. At Mahoney's Garden Center along the river, customers have been desperate. Are you hearing from gardeners that there are more squirrels than usual?
Yes. They can do a lot of damage. They can get into walls, they can get under foundations, and they can erode stonework and foundations and stuff so that, you know, it's a problem. And also they eat bulbs. When you plant bulbs in the fall, they eat the bulbs. So they're kind of destructive. There are lots of things you can do. I don't recommend that they do anything to kill the animals because I think it's wrong. If it's a bulb issue, they should cover their bulbs with chicken wire. There are also products you can buy, like powders, that have things that they don't like in them, like naphthalene, which is what you find in mothballs. And also a great one actually is hot pepper wax, which is simply cayenne pepper extract in wax.
So we're not crazy. There are more squirrels.
There definitely are more squirrels. Yeah. There was a squirrel in my kitchen about a month ago and bouncing off the cupboards.
In your house?
In my house.
And you don't need to be a gardener or a rower to know there are more squirrels this year. Any driver can see them, often when it's too late. In the early 90s, the Wall Street Journal estimated that over 34 million squirrels are killed on the nation's roads every year. This year, it sometimes feels as if that total could be reached just in New England. So what's going on here? There have been historic squirrel migrations, one in 1920, when thousands of the little critters just picked up and moved. We called Dr. Joseph Larson of the University of Massachusetts, a noted squirrel researcher, to find out more.
We've had a overproduction of squirrels. There's been good food. They go into the winter pretty fat, and they may be having more young than they normally have.
Yeah, they go into the winter fat and happy, and then reproduce.
Exactly.
Other than the fact that it's just horrendous to see them on the road, is there anything we should do or anything people should be concerned about?
Well, I think people are concerned primarily about damage, but gray squirrels will cause damage in a house, particularly if they get up into an attic, and they'll chew through electrical wires, and you know, they get into transformers and cause outages. They chew the lead lined telephone lines. Too many of them certainly is too many.
Dr. Joseph Larson of the College of Natural Resources and the Environment at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. So, yes, squirrels are, you'll pardon the expression, driving New Englanders nuts. But do an online search sometime. Squirrels have fan websites. It's hard to get around the fact they are so darn cute. Stay with us. More ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Skeletons are brought out of the British royal family's closet in the historical BBC drama The Lost Prince.
Nobody will see this. And tonight, we'll say our prayers twice. Maybe there won't be another one for a very long time.
The Lost Prince is based on the true story of Prince Johnny, born in 1905, the youngest son of George V and Queen Mary. He was hidden from the public by his parents, who were embarrassed by their son's epileptic fits and peculiar social habits. He was hidden away in the countryside as the British Empire crumbles and World War I looms. Then, unknown to the world, Prince Johnny died in 1919. The Lost Prince earned rave reviews and huge ratings when it premiered on BBC television. Now audiences in the States will have the opportunity to see for themselves what the fuss is all about. The Lost Prince premieres this weekend on public television's Masterpiece Theater. Stephen Polyakov is writer and director of The Lost Prince. He joins us from the studios of the BBC in Edinburgh, Scotland. Welcome.
Hi, hello.
First of all, how did you come to do this? I mean, how, if so little was known about Prince Johnny, how did you come to tell his story?
Well, I read one sentence about him years before in an obscure historical book, and I was quite interested, but then I could find nothing else about him at all. And then right in the last moments of the 20th century, about 1998, 1999, there were some photos published of Johnny from the estate of the Duke of Windsor, and they appeared in one of the British newspapers, and I got very fascinated by these images of this boy. And through a little bit of detective work and battering at the door of the Royal Archives, I was able to find enough about him to write the story.
Tell us more about him.
He's often described, if you look him up on the internet, he's often described as a child that was no more than a vegetable, which is very far from the truth. He was a rather charming boy who had what we would call, learning difficulties, a phrase they didn't know in those days. He also was an epileptic, and we're still frightened by epilepsy now. You know, very few of us ever see an epileptic fit. It's still such a mystery. Nobody quite knows what causes it. So, of course, 100 years ago, for the royal family to have an epileptic child, that was a very shocking and disturbing thing. But he was a charming boy who was able to say funny and humorous things about the world. He looked at the world slightly differently, and that was why I wanted to write the story, to see this extraordinary period of history through the eyes of this boy.
His family sends him away. We have a scene. Can you tell us first, where did he go?
He was secluded, first of all, in a sort of upstairs room in one of their smaller houses on their estate, and then he was moved to a secluded farmhouse, which, in fact, the royal family still possess. But they very rarely visited him during the whole of the First World War. His mother, Queen Mary, only saw him about twice, and he never saw his other brothers or sisters except for Georgie.
Let's listen as the doctors tell his parents, the King and Queen, that he should go.
John will have regular fits, and for anybody witnessing those fits, whether it is the immediate family or people outside the family, the effect will be most traumatic for anybody witnessing those.
For the child and for the family, this is best. A quiet place.
Stephen Polyakov, tell us more about how the world was unraveling and what this child, what he's witnessing. And we're not seeing it in your film. We're sort of seeing him understand it.
Well, we see him born into, it starts when he's about 4 or 5 years old, into the extraordinary splendor of Edward VII's court, played by Michael Gambon, where there was this magnificent, almost fairy tale splendor, birthday cakes with goldfish swimming in them and red carpets rolled along the beach so they wouldn't get their feet dirty. And we see in the very short span of his life, as he died when he was 13, that this whole world collapsed. The Russians' royal family was, of course, shot, which we see in the story, and we see how the English royal family could have saved them. And, of course, the First World War happened, and the British found themselves fighting the Germans, who were their cousins. So the whole fabric of the family that he was born into was completely torn apart. He was isolated in his own little world, and that's one of the strands of the story. He finds a sort of equilibrium while the rest of the adult world goes completely mad. And I wanted to write it like that, A, because, of course, I was haunted by the story of Johnny, but also because I felt it was a great way of catapulting yourself into history, because if we time-travelled, I'm sure we would stare at history as it unfolded, much like a child would, with a mixture of sort of a slight sense of apartness, but also a sense of wonder. And I felt this was a good way of dropping us into the middle of history.
Well, it is a visual banquet for those of us who love to see British history and masterpiece theatre, you know, in this country. But I'm wondering, how did Britons react to this scandal from their past?
Well, there was a little bit of, while we were making it, some of the right-wing newspapers ran stories about it and saying what a shocking thing this was to do, especially the year that the Queen Mum had died.
Because how would little Johnny be related to the current family?
Well, he's the Queen's uncle. He was the brother of the Queen's father. One of the brothers of the Queen's father. So a very direct relation, obviously. And in fact, an anecdotal piece of evidence came to me via somebody that worked on the production who knew a lord. And this lord had been visiting the Queen, and the Queen said, "Oh, they made a thing about Uncle Johnny. I must watch that." So as if he had just died the year before. So that was quite funny.
But I wonder, did the royal family react in any other way? Did they deny the story?
No, they didn't. No, they can't deny the story because it's true. I mean, you know, this boy existed and this boy died. I don't think there was any point writing a story that said, "Oh, these were cold-hearted people that behaved dreadfully," because they behaved very much like any upper Edwardian upper-class Edwardian family would have reacted with a child that had difficulties, as they saw it, with epilepsy and learning difficulties. I mean, they could have sent him away and shut him up. But the royal family, I think, well, I heard that they actually thought it was a reasonable portrait of the story. So I don't think they were outraged. Prince Charles found it very interesting, I was told. Again, I've not talked to them personally about this, I might add. This is just anecdotal evidence.
Well, he would have been only, 14 when he died. How did he die? Would it have been 14? I'm doing the math here.
13 and a half,
13
yeah.
And a half.
He died after a very big fit, and nobody's quite, yeah. Heart failure or something happened after a very severe fit, as I show in the story. They were getting increasingly bad, his fits, in his late adolescence. Mm. But his nurse, Gina McKee, this person who brought up all the royal children, including the Queen's father and the Duke of Windsor, Edward VIII, so she was the nanny to two kings. Johnny was her favourite, and for 50 years she was devoted to his memory. She had a huge blown-up photo of him above her mantelpiece in her retirement cottage, and she always said he was her favourite, as I tried to show that strong bond in the story. I mean, she was a very fearless servant, and although she had no children, so one of the reasons the story was so little known was that she also disappeared like a ghost. So all the people connected with the story disappeared, and that's why it requires so much detective work to find out the facts.
Sounds like you have another movie to make. Stephen Polyakov, writer and director of the BBC drama The Lost Prince, thank you for talking to us.
Thank you very much indeed. Thank you.
And the two-part film premieres in the U.S. this weekend on public television's Masterpiece Theater. Do not call me during Masterpiece Theater. For more information, check out our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Get into your radio and join us again. Here and Now. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.